Thanks. Today is January 27th, and we're going to learn Torah. Okay, we're in a good place. We're in Shmos.
420.
And everyone had it enough?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for knowing.
What?
Okay. Okay. Let's talk about God makes a promise, be gracious, to a chosen man. I've chosen you for my mission. You're the one who's getting my word out to the world. Right? But while it's certainly a good thing to be chosen, right, it sometimes gets you into some hot water. It sometimes makes things more difficult than everyone else who's not chosen. First of all, they may feel jealous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Avraham, throughout his time in Sefer Bereishis, does not ever like take advantage of any. He doesn't tell anyone in Canaan, I'm acting as if though I own this land. If anyone behaves that way, it's Lot, right?
Yeah.
Remember, that's according to Chazal why the shepherds fought. But be it as it may, it's not my purpose here is just to say that Avraham, shortly after being told he's chosen, is told by God that his descendants are going to be slaves in a strange land, they're going to be abused. And Avraham does not ask God, this is what it means to be chosen? HaBocher Ba'amo Yisrael Ba'ahava? Please, remember Tevye who's saying, God, but, should love someone else a little bit. Right? So I don't mean to chas v'shalom, but say this in a mocking tone, but what it means is that there is a lot more at what it means to be God's chosen than just to enjoy life and sip lemonade by a poolside. We're here for a different kind of mission, and even in the garden, our job was, as I ended last week, la'avda u'lishamra. We had a mission to work and to guard and to be guardians of something, and we started discussing this last week that it may not be dissimilar that just 3 years before historic renewal of our land after 2,000 years of wandering, the Jewish people also suffered its greatest suffering of that entire time. Is that sometimes a pendulum swings, and we sometimes can be greater actors with what's happening and have a, the Talmud tells us that there were some tribes that tried to avoid this some tribes that tried to leave early, right, and it was not successful, right. So sometimes we're participants in what's happening. Let's say when Nachshon ben Aminadav jumps into the Yamsuf, and only then it splits, right? So there is a moment where we actually make the thing happen, right? You go 18 words in the Talmud in the Mishnah, and you get your first machlokes. It's because our approach to godliness and our approach to practically everything we do is that there is more than one way to approach this thing. And we have to look back at Bereishis and look back at our history. Look back and say, is it better to get married the way Yitzchak got married? Is it better to get married the way Yaakov got married? Mm-hmm. So the answer to all this is it depends. It depends who you are. Are we living at a time when if we jumped ahead to do something messianic like the tribes of the tribe of Ephraim, that it would be not successful at this point? Or are we could be like Nachshon ben Aminadav, where God is just waiting, someone just jump in already and do something, right? So I take you back to the 1880s. There were very few Jews in America at the time. But in the 1880s, there was actually, this is before the 1897 First Zionist Congress. There was a meeting here in New York mostly Orthodox Jews. Reform was not so strong here yet, but Reform was strong in Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. But New York was mostly most Jews were Orthodox, And they had a meeting of in the Lower East Side of this idea of a Jewish homeland. Jewish homeland is not something foreign to great stories in the 1840s, 1850s of some Christians. There's a famous Christian who converted to Judaism and was fully accepted. He got smicha, and he considered himself the first ambassador of the United States to Israel. I'll tell the story another time. So anyway, they had this meeting, and they decided that it's not the time. It's like if we would do anything Zionistic, it would be like Ephraim, right? So here, Bnei Yisrael are in Egypt for how long? 210 years, our sages say. And Moshe sees a vision at the burning bush. Our first question is, didn't God tell Avram 400 years? And when we left, it says we were there 430 years. Right? So this is all part of the same mix-up. It's all about us today. Right? It's that there's always some confusion in our history over whether we can say, this is the time. We should be able to feel at every moment we can say, yes, this is the time. And then someone else might argue and say, well, maybe it's not the time. But here's the difference. The difference is that in Avraham's time, there was an announced amount. Just the only problem is, how can you know when 400 years ends unless you know when 400 years begins? The same is true about Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu, and I'm only using this because it's the trend. Do you know that Yirmiyahu mentions a 70-year waiting period in two different chapters? One is chapter 25, mm-hmm. One is chapter 29. Neither of them is a Haftorah, so we tend to not learn these things, but they're two separate chapters, and they're two separate
dates.
Read carefully. They're two separate dates and two separate purposes. One has to do with the Babylonians. One has to do with the temple. Right? First one, chapter 25, is all the chapter about all the nations of the world drinking from the cup of wine that the poison that the Babylonians are passing to everyone. And if you don't drink from this cup, then it will be worse for you. So this is the destruction of the nations from Babel. But then Babel will have to drink from the poisonous cup itself, because that is a nation that will so swiftly sweep through the world and in a wisp of history be gone, because the Persians are going to take over. The Assyrians were around for a much longer time than the Babylonians, which is why the Assyrians have left us so much more archaeology than the Babylonians. We have very little Babylonian archaeology about their time period. We only know of two or three, maybe four kings. And the Persians left us quite a bit, and the Assyrians left us quite a bit, the Babylonians very little. And then later in chapter 29, Yirmiyahu gives a 70-year exile period from the destruction of the temple, which is 20 years later than the first start. But guess what? By the time we're into year 70 from the first Cheshbon, right? I only know this from the Tanakh itself, of course, Sefer Daniel, maybe possibly Sefer Zechariah, that according to the Talmud, even in Megillas Esther, right? There are these questions about, well, isn't the 7-year period over, and why isn't anything happening? This is the problem when you give a specific date for things to happen, because when that date comes and nothing happens, we're all out of sorts. We're all out of luck. We're going to drop everything because nothing's happening. So today we were not given a time period. God didn't say when the Second Temple was destroyed. Right? And I think we'll go right into the burning bush. In Shmos chapter 3, as I'm speaking this, I think that's what's happening at the beginning of the Seder, when we say, Kol dichpin yesev yechol, kol ditzrich yesev yivsach. It's an acknowledgement on our part that we feel we can hasten the end of this exile, because that's how that chapter ends. Hashat ha'achol, l'shana ha'ba b'nei chor, and l'shat. Hashat Av, Shana Bav Yisrael, Hashat Av, Shana Bav Yisrael. Right? Here we're now in an exile. Next year we'll be in Israel. Famous line later, the Shana Baba Yerushalayim. Here we're slaves. Next year we'll be free. So we're hoping that through our Masim Tovim, through our acts of kindness, through inviting people who's hungry, who needs, and then we will hasten the exile as it were, which is of course what everyone's thinking about at the Seder. Right, so I assure you, for the vast majority of the time the Jews have been keeping the Seder the last 2,000 years, they were really, really thinking of the end of our exile and next year in Jerusalem. For us, next year in Jerusalem is a phone call to your travel agent, or even better, your cell phone, right? And you can next year, next week, tomorrow. All right, so, and as I think I've told you in a different setting, maybe last Wednesday, that if we asked 1,500 years ago, asked our ancestors, how will your life change 10 ways if you were fortunate enough to be alive when Mashiach comes, they would write 10 things down, and we have 8 or 9 of them. Mm-hmm. Right? So that is just a we're supposed to have different models for the end of our exile based on the stories of Tanakh, and our Seder is set up so that our model can be one where we can take some control.
Absolutely right. Because we are allowed to live in that society.
Okay,
there
good.
Is no prohibition.
Good.
Everyone can come.
But no one in this room...
Because it is difficult to get along with one another.
No one in this room knows as well as the person who's talking right now what it means, maybe Glenn knows as well, what it means to suffer significantly because you want to go to Israel and everyone around you doesn't want you to. Okay? He was with Natan Sharansky and friends. He just never made it to the Knesset, but he's the same hero that Natan Sharansky is. You should talk to him sometime. Okay. That's Yaakov Gorodetsky. Okay, so I'm just saying this for the tape to shout out for you. Everyone's listening.
Wow.
Okay, so let's go to chapter 3 in Sefer Shmos. So God ostensibly has not appeared to any of our people in almost 200 years, right? I mean, as far as, do we know any Midrashim that God appeared to Ephraim's grandchildren? I'm not familiar with any,
mm-hmm.
Right? Yosef and his brothers all die. The whole generation dies out. There's a new paro. He forgets all the good that Yosef did for him. And there's no story in between of what's happening. Now, there are some midrashim that fill in some of these gaps, but it's a really long gap. And ostensibly, during that time, I would just tell you, if you know your Tanakh, there's one chapter in the whole Bible that gives us a picture of this time. It is chapter 20 of Sefer Yechezkel. Right? Tells of the depravity in which the Israelites had descended in Egypt. All these midrashim, you know, about the 49 levels of impurity and tumah. So Yechezkel has a description of this. Cheskel is an incredible book of these kind of things. He has a chapter about the evil of Sodom, right? And the point is that you're behaving just like they did, right? Okay. So interesting. Now, this is very tangent to a tangent, but he mentions no sexual depravity in the chapter. Depravity is all about social decay, right? So Yechezkel does this kind of thing. He goes way back into history, right? And he goes and he speaks about the. There's even another chapter. He speaks about us as a newborn baby who's left out, you know, by its parents and just left in a basket. And was filled with blood and you know. And I say, well, what a newborn baby looks like is two seconds after it's born. And then the umbilical cord is still connected. Does it sound familiar? I'm paraphrasing in English. This is now chapter 16 of Sefer Yechezkel. And then God came and cut the umbilical cord and swaddled you and cleaned you and dressed you into little nice clothing and he raised you and grew you. And he said, "Be'amaloch b'damayeh chayi, v'amaloch b'damayeh chayi." And it's those are the words right across Yad Vashem, if you've been there recently as well, of course, at the front of the museum. And so Yechezkel gives us a glimpse of what these years were like. And it's not pretty. Okay? So Abravanel says something to resolve the contradiction of how many years we spent in Egypt. Abravanel says we were supposed to spend 400 years, but God tacked on another 30 because of bad behavior. Did you hear that answer? Okay, it says there were 430 years in Egypt, and when God predicted to Avram, it was 400 years. Okay. By the way, even Ibn Ezra was a real Pashtun. Ibn Ezra says it was 400 years from the time of the birth of Avraham's children. He says, Geri Yezaracho. So from the birth of Yitzchak, it's 400 years. From the time God told him this, it was 430. I'm going to discuss the, we think we give some other answers to this question another time. And so here, God is appearing to a human being for the first time, right? Actually, that's not fair. God is, when it says that God appears to Moshe at the burning bush, no, he appeared to someone before this. Tell me.
Did not show from who? No.
No. Now, you see, Chazal tell us that God was talking to Moshe for 7 days at the burning bush. Mm-hmm. Even if it's 7 days, God had to speak to Aharon first because he's just on his way. He's already almost there. Okay. So Aharon was the first person that God spoke to. From the text. Okay? Because Hashem tells him while he's still at the bush. Now, from the time it takes to read these two chapters, this whole conversation could have taken place in 20 minutes. Right? Okay, Chazal derived that it's a full 7 days because Moshe says, "Gamol Shalshoma." All right, I don't know, but whatever it is, it's been a long time. God is finally talking to us again. What changed? Why does God start talking about it? Because the time is up. What else is there to say? All right, we haven't behaved too well, right? Chazal do tell us that we didn't change our names, our dress.
And
right? So the names that we see all this time seem to be Semitic names. They're not Egyptian names, right?
Names.
Okay. So
speech. Language.
Okay. And language, the dress,
name,
the names.
Clothes and language.
Right. Okay. So Moshe Hayaro es tzon Yisro chosno kohen midyan. So God is not going to appear to Moshe while he's living in as an Egyptian prince, right? God appears to Moshe as a shepherd. Okay, shepherds are at least in biblical times, holy occupations, mm-hmm. right? They give you a time to contemplate. Yechezkel also, if I may say, refers to the chapter 34 as the shepherds of first the leaders of Israel as the shepherds. Only they're not doing their job, he says, that Tzon are leading the Ro'im, he says. Okay, so Moshe Ro'ez Tzon Yisro Chosno Kohen Midyan Vayin Hag Es Atzon Achar HaMidbar. Perek Yom HaPasuk Aleph, page 136, I think. So Vayin Hag, he guided the sheep to the edge of the desert. Ve'yavo El Haro HaElohim Choreva. All right, so God is about to appear to Moshe, and Moshe's first question is, why me, God? Does the reader know why Moshe? I mean, Avraham hasn't been described when God appears to him. Noah was. Mm-hmm. When God chooses someone. I think the reader has plenty of information about Moshe. Those three arguments he gets into to help people who are weak or who are... Right? Mm-hmm. Why does he go to Achar HaMidbar? Have you ever heard Midrashim about that? Why is he going to? Why should the reader care whether he's on one side of the desert, the other side of the desert, at the end of the desert? Who cares? So, what does Achar HaMidbar mean? So, if you're Rashi, you care that the leader of Israel should be moral. So, why does he go Achar HaMidbar?
Sheep not eat other people's grass.
To stay away from possibly grazing on someone else's land. Has to be in a hefker. If I go to Zunt, to Achar HaMidbar, way out in the desert. So to Rashi, he wants to stress that element. To to Sforno, he's going Achar HaMidbar Lihitbogdeid. Because God's chosen should be spiritual. He should be a breast lover. He should be you know what I'm saying? He should be a Hasidic kind of guy too. According to Shmos Rabbah, he went out to the edge of the desert because he chased inadvertently chased a sheep out into the desert who he thought would die of the elements, and he ran right after it just to get one sheep. Not because of its value, because I don't want it to die a gruesome death way out in the desert. And as soon as he catches up to him, God says, that's the one I'm going to appear to. That Mendomar says that the leader of Israel must first and foremost be a man of compassion. Okay? So whether or not he knows it's Har HaElohim Choreva or not, I mean, the second opinion, he went with Bodeit. He knew he was going to a special mountain. Did you know? Does he know that it's Har HaElohim Choreva? Right?
There was nothing special about it at the time.
There was
nothing special about it.
Okay, Rashi says Al Shem Ha'atid, it's called this.
Yes, but he didn't know that.
Okay, well, the Sforno says that he had a sense that there's some reason to go out there. Okay, so have you ever read Plato's Republic and his theory of knowledge?
Many years ago, right?
Remember, in many of the editions of Plato's Republic, there are pictures in the book of what I'm about to describe, of the man who acquires knowledge on five levels. Familiar with it? And he gives it as a parable of a man who's in a cave, no light for years. Mm-hmm. His eyes have stopped being able to reflect any light.
Right.
And how can he somehow go out to see the sunlight again? So if he walks straight out of the cave now and looks even at the ground, and certainly looks at the sky, he will go blind immediately. Mm-hmm. So he discusses five different stages of acquiring the knowledge. This is known in philosophical lingo as epistemology. Right. So Rabbeinu Bachayai, I don't know if he ever read Plato's Republic, but says the same thing in our section here about how a human being can receive the divine visit the first time. Because Moshe first sees, right? Because the first thing that comes out to him is Vayera Malach Hashem Elav. Well, Malach Hashem, I thought it was God who spoke to Moshe from the burning bush, right? And here it says an angel looked out at him from the fire, mitoch ha-sneh. The sneh, let's just say, is a thorn bush. I think Rashi says that in shochni sneh. But okay, vayera, vayar v'hinei ha-sneh bo'er bo'eish v'ha-sneh, and then it will call. Right? The bush is burning, but the bush is not consumed. Okay. I don't know who he's talking to. He seems to be alone. He's out in the desert. Mm-hmm. So probably he was talking to a sheep, maybe. No, he's saying to himself, that looks strange. So at first he sees what is probably a common sight in the desert.
A fire.
A bush on fire is a common sight. It's
dry, it's hot.
Dry, hot, it happens. But the things that are in the desert are so dry that they usually burn up quickly. This is an interesting Hebrew thing because he says hasne bo'er, and then the next person he says lamadua lo yiv'ar. So you probably have to do some English. If you're going to translate those two words in English, you can't just use the same word. You could say, well, it's burning, but it's not being consumed, but the Hebrew uses the same word. So may I suggest, I don't know what your English says right now, but that he sees a bush burning and he's wondering why it's not burning up. What does it say there?
Because
ukal will be consumed. But no, but the next pasuk it says, Madua lo yiv'ar. What does it say in the
next pasuk? Why will the bush not be burned?
What does it say? Why isn't the bush burning?
Why will the bush not be burned?
Why will the bush not be burned? Okay, fair enough. Burned, I guess it doesn't want to add the word up because it's not there. But why will it not be? But your English, when you hear the English, you say a bush being burned means it's being
consumed,
burned up. Because the bush is burning. Mm-hmm. Make up your mind. Is the bush burning or is it not burning? Anyway, that's just a Hebrew lesson. But you get the point that the Hebrew does justice for Madu'a lo yivar hasneh. The English maybe is not equipped so well to use the same word, right? I have to add burning up, burning, you know. Okay, anyway, okay.
But if it burns already,
why is he still seeing the bush in the fire? Right. That's the question. All right. That's sight number two. First he saw a common sight. Then he saw what looks like an uncommon sight. Then there's three other stages that Rabbeinu Bechaya points out. And it's fascinating because he also says it in five stages, like Socrates, but he doesn't quote Socrates. Socrates, of course, about 1,500 years before Rabbeinu Bechaya. But he's so he says that the third stage is to see the angel. The fourth stage is that, be careful and notice, it's Elohim that talks to him first from the bush, and then it's the God's name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei.
Mm.
So God has to, that's why he appears in Bereishis. First Bereishis Bar Elohim, mm-hmm. and then God appears as Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, with, you know, the ineffable God, right? God, it's the human mind can't speak to Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei for the first time. We have to, now, this shouldn't sound chas v'shalom heretical in any way. I don't mean to say that there are divisible parts of God. There are different revelations of God. And the human being may be exposed to different revelations of God, and they may have to come in a certain order for the human being to perceive and process what is being experienced. Okay, there are biblical authors who speak of some type of physicality. Yeshayahu describes in his dream, we're going to have it as Haftorah in a few weeks, of seeing God sitting on a throne.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine that's the sense data that you're not actually seeing in the dream, you're seeing something else that's conjured by your brain and the rapid eye movement. Is something that we just don't usually see that because the Jew doesn't have that experience, you know, of quantifying God in a picture. Right? You know what I'm saying? So I don't want to contemplate what other religions that actually allow such quantification of the deity. Islam certainly doesn't, just like Judaism doesn't. But there are some other religions that do, where a person person who worships that religion might experience that on a regular basis, right, in a dream. So Yeshayahu has such a vision. And Yaakov says, "I saw God." Oh, Manara, right? In Parshas Vayetze. So Moshe is seeing something that makes him turn away, right? I'll tell you if you go to the Daf Yomi just a few days ago, the Daf Yomi discussed this and said, "No, you were mistaken. Bless you. You should have stood there and hold your ground and look." I don't know. Moshe turns away. It's part of his inner humility that I sense that there's something significant happening here that I should not be looking at. Right? It's the same humility that Yeshayahu demonstrates what I just described afterwards.
Where is that? Verse 6?
Yeah. In Yeshayahu, it's chapter 6, beginning of chapter 6 in Yeshayahu. It's also the humility, if you will, that Shimshon's parents exhibit when they see the angel. Uh-huh. It's the humility that Gidon exhibits when he sees the angel. It's the humility that Nadav and Avihu B'davka do not exhibit. It's the humility that the people that in Parshas Mishpatim, it says they ate and they drank, you know what I'm talking about? Perhaps the humility that the people of Beit Shemesh, when the Aron came back, if you recall in chapter 6 of Shmuel Aleph, that they didn't exhibit. Uh-huh. These, we can see two different sides of this. And maybe the person who finds himself in between these two is the Haftorah of Nadav and Avihu, where that poor guy who pushes back the Aron.
Mm-hmm.
His name?
That's a tough decision.
Well, he didn't have time to really give it any thought, but let's not get bogged down on that.
All right.
So that's Moshe's initial reaction is I shouldn't be seeing this. Right. So that in itself, by turning away, means that he is inherently a spiritual person. Someone who's just he knew what it was, and he instinctively knew that he should be turning away from it. Right? Now, you can argue, well, maybe it was just too bright. If he had looked at it, he would have gone blind. All right, now you can say anything you want about that, but it was obviously something so out of the ordinary that made him turn away. But let's ask this question. It's a question Rashi deals with so succinctly. It's so beautiful. This, you can make a shiur, an hour shiur, just on this one short Rashi. Velo ilan acher ki imo anochi b'tzara. What is the question that made Rashi say these few words? God appears to Moshe in a burning thorn bush. Velo ilan acher. God could have appeared in a burning oak, in a burning sequoia, in a burning redwood. You know, why not appear in this? This is God. Wow, look at that 1,000 feet tall thing on fire. Wow. Amazing. Right? Instead, God appears in this little bramble there near the ground. Velo ilan acher ki imo anochi b'tzara. It's a pasuk in Tehillim, chapter 90. I am with you in your pain. Rashi, you know, says that's why a thorn bush and not an olive tree, but he's also on fire, right? So that's pretty painful too, yeah. So here's an interesting thing. This is a bit of scholarship and what I'm about to tell you. Vilna Gaon actually wrote a little commentary on this. There's a medrash called Medrash Desanya. Medrash Desanya, Samach Nun Yud Yud Aleph. It is of ancient time. It's from the Tanayim. And it's a medrash that starts with the question, Amar of Shimon Bar Yochai, why did God appear to Moshe in a burning thorn bush? Okay? If you have Nechama Leibowitz on the Parsha, I do believe, I haven't seen it in maybe 30 years, but I do believe she has a chapter on this. Right? I don't know if she quotes this medrash called Medrash Desanya, Dafka. The Vilna Gaon makes a very bold claim that this medrash is the beginning of the Mechilta to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Right? If you know your Mechilta, it only starts with HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, because it's only on Halacha, it's Medrash Halacha, so it doesn't have anything on the first 11 chapters of Shmos, because it's the storyline. So, but Vilna Gaon claims that even Medrash Halacha have some Agadah to them, and that this medrash that begins with this question is actually the beginning of the Mechilta. Okay, enough of that. Now, what we have is 12 different explanations for why God appeared to Moshe in a burning thorn bush. Listen to some of them, right? And then try to figure out why Rashi says what he says. Ready? One. A thorn bush has thorns that usually turn in, so that if you put your hand into the bush,
you
will
get
not hurt.
All the other way
but
out.
If you try to pull your hand out, you're going to pull it and scratch as you're pulling it out. Got it? In order to teach that the journey into Egypt was not, as Yaakov dreaded, I'll be taken down in chains. The journey into Egypt was, which is the thorn bush, was relatively peaceful. Came in invited guests. But the trip out, I'm sorry to tell you, Moshe, will not be without as seamless.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's one. Two. Moshe, you people have not seen me so clearly of the last, you know, some dozens of years, but I can be seen everywhere and anywhere, even in a lonely thorn bush. Okay. Another interpretation. The enemies of Israel will try to burn you in fire, but you are a thorn bush that cannot be consumed. They will never succeed in doing so. They may try to burn you, they may try to destroy you, but you are a bush that cannot be consumed. Right?
That could be any tree, not just a thorn bush, though.
Okay, so you're approaching this in the right direction. So, let me just see if I should give you a few more. But I think you have the picture enough now. Why does Rashi choose this interpretation? I'm choosing to appear to you in the burning thorn bush because I want to teach you that I am always with you in your pain. I feel your pain. So it would be fascinating to just write down all these interpretations and see. You see what the one about the hand going in and turning out is very appealing, but it's obviously wrong because according to that opinion, what does the thorn bush represent?
Israel itself.
Egypt.
Egypt. The hand is Israel. But the thorn bush itself is Egypt. It's not Egypt talking to Moshe from the bush, right? But it's relevant to the story, right? And if you want to say that it's, since it's God talking to him in the bush, right? So to say that I appear even in lowly thorn bushes, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that might be relevant to Egypt, but it's not, it's, it could be, that's a message that should be taught in any time, that God can be found in every avenue and every venue. But the one that the Rashi chose, not just because of its moral message and its message of hope, is that it is God talking to Moshe after all from the thorn bush, right? And it's relevant to the story at hand. I'm with you in this current pain, right? Okay, so that's why God chooses. Plus, you know, it's pretty pashut that when you have the power, you never have to really show it off, right? So God always appears, and that's how human beings should learn as well. Why does Hashem tell him to take off his shoes? Keep in mind that God also told Yehoshua to do the same.
And at the Beit HaMikdash, they don't wear shoes.
The Talmud tells us that the Kohanim removed their shoes for a separate reason, but that seems to be it. I want you to connect to the ground. This is a holy place. You're going to receive the Torah at this place. And I want you to remember it. I want you to recognize you're on hallowed ground. And I want you to keep that in mind, because the story isn't going to be over until you get back here. That's what Hashem is about to tell him. Why are you telling me to do this? Ki ta'avdunis elokim b'har hazeh. Such a crucial element of the Haggadah also, that the point of Yetzias Mitzrayim is not your freedom. The point of Yetzias Mitzrayim is to get you into the land and to get you the Torah. Remember we did that last week, right? What was the Rechush Gadol? Was it the money? Was it the land? Was it the Torah? So that the ultimate purpose of this. But I want to share with you a very interesting comparison. That when Moshe was holding up his arms, that mm-hmm. you know, so the Gemara asks, why was that of necessity? Is that Moshe should feel uncomfortable? Now, people are fighting. I want you, and they'll look at you like a flag. So it's just that this is one pay, which is that there must have been a lot of rocks around. If you take off your shoes, you're going to feel uncomfortable. Moshe, you will only succeed if you get out of your comfort zone and go. I must tell you, I saw this, I think in the parish of Rav Sadia Gaon, is that when Moshe goes to Egypt, he's 80, right? When he left, right, he left
the
palace, we're not told how old he is, it just says Vayigdal Hayeled, Vayigdal Moshe, and he his first day out, and you know, seeing the sights. The Medrash says he was 20. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, it's hard to imagine, because he seems to have a child with Tzipora right away, and then he has a child here just as he's going back. Maybe there was like 60 years between these kids, 40 mm-hmm. years between the Yerushim and Eliezer. I mean, it's very strange, right? It's a topic for the parsha of the week. But Chazal tell us that Moshe spent many years before he got to Midian someplace else.
Mm. Right? There are such midrashim.
Right. That's
a king in some place.
Yeah. He spent many years someplace else. He spent relatively very little time in Midian. Then there's a whole other approach to this, that Moshe went to Egypt two different times. He went once so that the people were not ready to accept him. Mm-hmm. And then God tacked on the 30 years then. Huh. And then God told him, now it's time to go back. Maybe now they'll accept. Hmm. I'm just putting it out there. I don't want to get too confused. Right? I'm not sure. I'm not saying I agree with it. I just want always leave it out, because there's no one way to read anything. Okay, so now, so that's all. He takes off his shoes. And then Hashem gives him the message. Okay? So, just quickly we run through it. God says, this is what I want you to do. And Moshe says, who am I to take them out? Bless you. Mm-hmm. And so Hashem tells him, this is the mission. That's why I'm talking to you on this mountain. It's not finished until you get back to this mountain. Fine. So then Moshe says, okay, God, I know the first thing they're going to ask is your name. What is that? So that doesn't just mean the name. My name is, Richard Harris. That's not, no, my name is my revelation. Right? This is how I'm going to reveal myself. I revealed myself to the Avos as El Shaddai, which is more in a natural order. Zesha Mar Dai. Right? Mm-hmm. Dai means enough. And now I recognize I have to reveal myself in a different way. Not a name that Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov heard me say. You'd give up your names that God spoke to them, the patriarch. Just that they didn't see me with the revelation of what that, or the fullness of what that means. So Hashem answered him for that question. Right? This is your name. Then Moshe says, but God, even if now I know your name, what good is it? I can't pronounce it. Okay? So this is amazing. The Rabbeinu Bachai, so Hashem says, listen, my name is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. There's no stutterer on earth that can't say those words, right? Yeah, sure. You don't have to be. It's very easy to pronounce. You're looking really behind on that. But Hashem is just saying, listen, if you think that you stutter, what are you worried about? I'm behind you. Remember we spoke about last time the signs that went from A B A. Remember, a stick turned into a snake. Stick.
Right.
Blood, water, water, blood, water. And hands to be leprous, and then to be back to the same. So you started with A, you became a shepherd. A was talking to kings. Don't you recognize? You grew up in a palace. You can go back to a palace and talk in a palace. You can do those things again. So then Moshe. Okay, so that's objection number three. Objection number four is God v'hein lo yanim. You're not going to accept. The one time I went out to talk to them, they rejected me. I had to leave because well, look how they talked to me, right? That we did last week, you recall, right? Remember, we did mm-hmm. because he based their acceptance on the miracles that he showed them. He jumbled on and showed the miracles too quickly.
Emotional,
emotional, intellectual. So then, finally, when God answered that question and said, "Okay, Moshe, listen. According to Rashi, God showed them you sinned." You spoke like a forked tongue, like a snake. You spoke Lashon Hara, here's your leprosy, and you spilled blood. The signs are very meaningful to Rashi. Right? But according to Ramban, God says, you know, Moshe, you're right. You're right. They are going to reject you after Paro doesn't let you go. But here I'm going to give you this nice staff, and you're going to perform miracles, and you're going to convince them. It's up to you to do this. So Moshe just then says, God, Shlach Nabi Yad Tishlach. Which
send
means
them
send some of us, and then God gets angry. Mm-hmm. It took five times, a lot of fives in our story. Five levels of subjugation, first the tax masters, then of others parach, by Moris Chayehem, midwives killing boys secretly, and then Bayamal Cholamo. And there are five levels of getting out of the subjugation. God says if you tell them God will cut to be evasive. So there are a lot of five levels of things that are happening all over the early Shmos story. And Moshe, the fifth time of his complaint, Hashem gets angry. And he just says, Moshe, forget it. I'm not gonna accept any more of your objections. You think that you're not up to this? Okay, your brother's on his way to meet you. This is actually a beautiful part of the story. Is that Moshe does back down at this point. Maybe God, made it an offer he couldn't refuse. But when God tells him, Moshe, your brother is on his way already. He's happy for you. And then Moshe goes, no more complaints. Which is what the cue Chazal took to say that Moshe's objection, without saying it in so many words,
was why did you pick me?
Why are you picking me? I stutter, my brother doesn't. My brother's, whatever he knew about his brother from the little time they spent together. So this is it's a beautiful, sort of beautiful kapara for the gracious and the, the lack of brotherhood and gracious is the way that the brothers do these two brothers do join. I take you back before we close to a fascinating Rabbi Chassid, where it says, I shared it last week, that Paro's daughter looks into the basket. He says, the Yaldeha Ivrim Zeh. Duh, who else is putting out babies like this, right? Father's decree. Right? So because she saw he was circumcised, but whatever it is, she says, oh, this must be the Yaldeha Ivrim. He says, she opened up the Nineh. The word yelled can describe a one-day-old baby and maybe a nine-year-old boy. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But so fine.
Na'ar is someone older. Not a baby.
Yeah, Nar describes Yahushua at the age of 56, for goodness sake. Nar, you can go from maybe 10 to much older, fine. But Nar does not describe a 3-month-old baby.
Right.
So Yerud HaChosid says
Aaron is standing by Christ.
Aaron. Miriam was there. Miriam was there with him in the water. Aaron was crying in the distance because some of the other family members were looking from, and Aaron would say, what are you doing to my brother? What are you taking him away? Right? So Miriam is right there. V'hinei nar bochez bat Aaron.
That the nar is referring to Aaron.
Aaron, yes.
Oh.
Aaron was crying over, what are you doing with my brother? Okay. So this conclusion is now goes full circle with Moshe finally agreeing to go, because now I know that my brother's on his way and he's happy. Okay, we'll close with that. We have Marav upstairs. Charles is the number 10.